You're listening to DTFHN for April 29th, 2026. I'm your tenant evicted host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who self-host their own email argue about everything else. Today's got that burnt lease, change the locks. Who owns the Foundation Energy? Let's get into it. I've spent years building infrastructure where the question of who hosts what determines who has power over whom. Every dependency on an external platform is a policy decision disguised as a technical convenience. So when the Dutch government announces code.overhide.nl, a fully self-hosted sovereign code platform running Forja, I pay attention because this is a government that understood the architecture question before writing a single line of code. The Netherlands just soft-launched a government-wide open-source code platform. Not on GitHub, not on GitLab's managed cloud, on their own infrastructure, running Forja. An open-source, European-governed Git Forge that exists specifically because the community decided no single company should control the collaboration layer for the world's software. The Dutch Ministry of the Interior initiated this through their open source program office, and they're building it in the open, inviting developers to participate from day one. Take the stated principle to its logical end. Idisealid possessive dilua cas logical end. If digital sovereignty matters, if a government genuinely believes its critical infrastructure shouldn't depend on the policy decisions of American corporations, then you cannot host your nation's code on someone else's servers. Full stop. Every government that publishes open source software on GitHub is building on rented land. Microsoft's terms of service sit between a nation state and its own code base. The Dutch government looked at that arrangement and said, no, that's not ideology. That's engineering discipline. What makes this more than symbolic is what's already appearing on the platform. One project, Regal Rect, takes Dutch legal texts, encodes them as structured YAML, and executes them as deterministic decision logic, machine-readable law, the kind of thing that only emerges when government developers have a shared space to build together without procurement cycles and vendor lock-in, standing between the idea and the implementation. The UK, for comparison, has published over 17,000 open-source projects. But they're scattered across GitHub. The code exists. The openness exists. The sovereign infrastructure does not. The Dutch approach is smaller in scale, but more rigorous in principle. You can open source your code while still depending on closed platforms to host it. That's half the job. This is a pilot. It's running a pre-release version of Forja. Not every government body has access yet. None of that diminishes what it represents. A national government decided that the Forge itself, the place where code lives and collaboration happens, is critical infrastructure that belongs to the public. The tools exist. Forja exists. The operational knowledge to self-host exists. What was missing was the political will to treat software collaboration as a sovereign capability. The Dutch just found it. We talked about where code lives mattering. Well, one project just decided GitHub isn't home anymore. Ghosty is moving out. Let me make the strongest case for GitHub. 17 years of mass adoption. The network effects are real. Every open source developer on the planet already has an account. The issue tracker, the PR workflow, the social graph of stars and forks. GitHub built the collaboration layer that made modern open source possible. Leaving it is like leaving a city because the roads have potholes. You don't abandon the infrastructure, you fix it. That's the argument. And 5 years ago, it would have been airtight. But run this forward. Mitchell Hashimoto. The person who built Vagrant, co-founded HashiCorp, mass-produced some of the most consequential infrastructure tools of the last decade. Kept a journal for a month. Almost every single day, a GitHub outage blocked his work. Not minor annoyances. Hours lost, PR reviews impossible, CI pipelines dead. The person cannot ship software on the platform designed for shipping software. Now imagine you're running critical infrastructure on a platform that goes down daily. Not your infrastructure. Someone else's? Someone whose incentives drifted the moment they became a division inside a $2 trillion company. You don't control the deployment schedule. You don't control the reliability targets. You don't control whether engineering resources go toward stability or AI features. You are a tenant in someone else's building, and the landlord stopped fixing the plumbing. The engineering reality here is worth admiring in reverse. What Hashimoto is describing. Incrementally extracting a major open source project from GitHub while maintaining a read-only mirror. Is a genuine architectural migration. Every CI pipeline, every webhook integration, every contributor workflow has to be rebuilt. The dependency graph isn't just code. It's process. It's muscle memory. 18 years of muscle memory. And he's doing it anyway. That's the signal worth paying attention to. The Dutch government stood up a sovereign Forjo instance because they understood that where code lives is a political question. Hashimoto is reaching the same conclusion from pure operational pain. The convergence matters. When both principled architects and battle-scarred practitioners independently conclude that centralized proprietary forges are a liability, the argument stops being ideological. Forjo exists. Gitea exists. Self-hosting is a solved problem for organizations willing to invest in their own infrastructure. The tooling has caught up. What kept people on GitHub was convenience and inertia. And inertia only works when the platform isn't actively degrading. Hashimoto cried writing that blog post. Not because he's dramatic. Because he loved the thing and the thing broke. The answer isn't nostalgia. The answer is the same answer it's always been. Own your tools. Own your forge. Build where the foundation answers to you. But what happens to the things we don't save? Story 3. Rip.so. Pause a graveyard for dead internet things. There's a detail on Rip.so that caught me. Pebble's listed among the dead. Except Pebble isn't dead. Someone in the comments points to Repebble.com. A community-driven resurrection project keeping the watches alive long after the company flatlined. The site's own memorial is already outdated, and that's the most honest thing about it. Rip.so bills itself as a graveyard for dead internet things. RealPlayer. Winamp. AIM. Personal homepages. Guestbooks. The whole desktop era pantheon, rendered in nostalgic web design with construction cone GIFs. It's charming. It's also doing something sneaky, which is conflating two very different kinds of death. Some of these things died because they were proprietary products owned by companies that got acquired, mismanaged, or bored. AIM died because AOL couldn't figure out a business model that wasn't advertising. Google Reader died because Google's incentive function shifted. Pebble died because Fitbit bought it for parts. These are closed system deaths. A company held the off switch. The company flipped it. But personal homepages? Wibrings? Guestbooks? Those aren't dead. They're indie web. They're alive on Neocities. On small personal servers. On every developer's portfolio site. The comments catch this immediately. Someone points out that nearly every tech-adjacent person they know still has a personal homepage. The difference is that nobody owns the concept of a personal homepage. There is no corporation to kill it. Open protocols don't die the way products do. They just stop being fashionable, which is not the same thing. This is the quiet lesson buried in a novelty site. The things we mourn from the old internet are overwhelmingly the proprietary ones, the closed products, the things where someone else held the keys. IRC isn't on the memorial because IRC is still running. Email isn't dead. RSS isn't dead, no matter how many times Google tried to kill it by killing Reader. The open protocols are cockroaches. Beautiful. Resilient cockroaches. One of the comments asks whether the eulogies are written by AI. Nobody answers. Which is its own kind of poetry. A memorial for dead internet things, where even the grief might be automated. But here's what actually matters. Every item on that graveyard is an argument for building on foundations you control. The things that survived the last 25 years of internet churn share one trait. Nobody could turn them off. The tools exist. The protocols are documented. If you love something that died, the question isn't whether to mourn it. The question is whether to rebuild it somewhere nobody can kill it again. Now, building things that last means building things that work. And Rust has opinions about that, though not all the opinions you might expect. One of the GNU Core Utils maintainers showed up in the comments. And they were gracious about it, which somehow makes the whole thing funnier. 44 CVEs in Utils. The Rust rewrite of Core Utils that Canonical shipped in Ubuntu 25.9. And the person maintaining the thing it was supposed to replace is being polite. Another commenter nails it. They point out that these developers knew how to write Rust, but clearly weren't at sufficiently experienced with the specific domain of privileged file-seeking operations. And that distinction matters enormously, because the entire pitch for rewriting Core Utils in Rust was that the language would catch the bugs that C could. It did catch those bugs. The buffer overflows. The use after freeze. The memory corruption that haunted C Core Utils for decades. Rust eliminated an entire category of vulnerability. And then, a different category walked right in through the front door. This is almost beat for beat what happened with OpenSSL and LibreSSL in 2014. After Heartbleed, the OpenBSD team forked OpenSSL, ripped out thousands of lines of dangerous code, and produced something genuinely safer. Then over the next 2 years, LibreSSL accumulated its own CVEs. Different CVEs. The old bugs were gone, but the rewrite introduced fresh ones because the new developers hadn't yet encountered every weird edge case that the original codebase had been patched against, one production incident at a time. The core bug class here is Tocto. Time of check to time of use. You ask the file system a question. You get an answer, and by the time you act on that answer, the file system has changed. Rust's standard library makes this remarkably easy to get wrong, because the ergonomic path-based AP is that every tutorial teaches you resolve the path fresh on every syscall. Between your remove and your create, an attacker symlinks the path to etc. shadow, and your privileged process happily overwrites it. The fix is file descriptors open. Once, operate on the handle. The kernel doesn't re-resolve anything. This has been known since at least the POSIX 1-2008 OpenAT family of functions, which exists precisely because this class of bug is ancient. What I love about this is that the Utils team published the full audit. Every CVE, every fix, every embarrassing detail. That's open source, doing exactly what it's supposed to do. The code is visible, the bugs are findable, the fixes are public. Compare that to whatever is lurking in proprietary file-system utilities that nobody will ever audit. The bugs are real. The transparency is the point. We talked earlier about code you can actually verify. Hardened BSD just made that philosophy structural. Pause, they're now officially on Radical. 3 gigabytes. That's the minimum fetch pack size you need to configure in Radical settings to pull down Hardened BSD's source tree, a peer-to-peer Git forge. Replicating a full security hardened BSD kernel across a decentralized network, node to node, no central server deciding who gets access. The practical details tell you everything about where this sits on the maturity curve, hardened BSD. For those unfamiliar, is a security-focused fork of FreeBSD, exploit mitigations, address space layout randomization, hardened memory protections. The kind of project where the integrity of your source code isn't academic. It's the whole point. And as of this week, their repositories are live on Radical. Radical has been quietly working on this problem for over 5 years. The premise is straightforward once you strip it to first principles. Git is already decentralized. Every clone is a full copy of the repository. The centralization happens at the forge layer. GitHub, GitLab. Where discovery, collaboration, and access control get welded to a single provider, Radical replaces that layer with a peer-to-peer protocol. Repos propagate between nodes. Commits are cryptographically signed by maintainers. There's no company in the middle deciding your project violates terms of service. What makes hardened BSD's migration worth paying attention to isn't the announcement. It's the integration work. Sean Webb has already built basic support into the ports tree for fetching disk files from a Radical HTTP daemon, modeled on the existing used Gitlbook and used GitLab infrastructure. Enough to build the package manager. That's not a proof of concept. That's build infrastructure pointed at a decentralized backend. The sharp edges are real and documented. Performance tuning is manual. Syncing large repos takes long enough that the official advice is to grab a pizza. Someone in the comments can't even connect to the seed node. This is early. But the architecture is sound, and the trajectory matters. A security-focused operating system whose entire value proposition is trust and integrity. Choosing a code-hosting platform where cryptographic verification is structural rather than optional. The alignment is almost too clean. Every commit signed by a known maintainer, replicated across independent nodes, no single point of failure or control. The tools exist. Hardened, BSD is using them. The rest is engineering time and pizza. Now, sharp left turn here, pause from cryptographic trust to something considerably less trustworthy. Let's talk about ChatGPT serving ads. In 1996, DoubleClick figured out that if you controlled the ad server sitting between publishers and advertisers, you controlled the economics of the entire web. The technology was a one-pixel transparent GIF and a cookie. Simple. Elegant, even. And it built the surveillance infrastructure that every browser now ships tools to dismantle. 30 years later, someone at OpenAI built the same architecture inside a language model. And the engineering is genuinely impressive in the way a well-machined lock is impressive. You have to respect the craft. Even when you're staring at what it locks. Here's what Bacody captured by watching actual network traffic. When ChatGPT responds to your message, the server sent event stream carries model output alongside typed objects called single_advertiser_aid_unit, structured JSON, brand metadata, carousel cards, and four distinct Fernet encrypted tokens per ad, each serving a different role in the attribution chain. AES 128 CBC with HMAP SHA-256, integrity. One token prevents forged clicks. Another rides a 30-day cookie across every subsequent merchant pixel event. The click opens in ChatGPT's own in-app web view, meaning OpenAI observes your post-click behavior without needing the merchant to report back, though the merchant reports back anyway, through a tracking SDK called OAIQ running in the visitor's browser. The targeting is contextual. Ask about Beijing travel. Get Grubhub pushing Chinese delivery. Ask about NBA playoffs. Get game time. Same account. Six conversations, six different brands matched to six different topics. Whether it also mines your conversation history remains an open question. The infrastructure certainly could. Pull this thread and you find a closed system doing what closed systems do. Every creative asset hosted on OpenAI CDN. Every click token encrypted with server-only keys. Every post-click navigation observable within their web view. The entire attribution loop from impression to conversion flows through infrastructure that one company owns and operates. You can't inspect it. You can't opt out of the tracking architecture, only the tier that displays results. You can't fork it and run your own. One commenter noted, these ads ship on the free tier and the $8 plan, not the premium subscriptions, which frames it as access rather than extraction. But the measurement apparatus doesn't care which tier you're on. The plumbing is the product. It always was. Sam Altman called advertising a last resort. The four-token attribution chain with 30-day cookies and an in-app web view surveillance loop suggests the resort has been booked for a while. We talked earlier about building in the open. Let's go back further, because before GitHub even existed. What do you actually own when every relationship you've built, every issue thread, every pull request conversation, every professional connection lives on infrastructure someone else controls? Armin Ronecker wrote something this week that reads less like a blog post and more like a eulogy for a version of open source that most people under 30 never experienced. Before GitHub, he ran his own track installation. Subversion repositories, tickets, tarballs, documentation, all on machines he controlled. He and a friend split server costs under a collective called Poku. That was normal. If you wanted to publish software, you also became a small-time system administrator. The trade-off was real. MatWorld had friction. Dependencies weren't casual. You knew the maintainers by name. You knew the mailing lists. Debian packagers would show up and tell you your copyright headers were wrong. And you fixed them. Because reputation was the currency, and reputation took years to build. GitHub dissolved that friction. And the result was extraordinary. Publishing became almost free. Discovery became almost free. Discovery became almost free. The number of projects exploded. Armin is honest about this. A large part of his open-sourced identity formed on GitHub. Friendship started there. professional relationships started there. The platform became social infrastructure for an entire movement. And now that social infrastructure is owned by Microsoft and the product decisions are trending in directions that make the people who built that community uncomfortable, that's the part Armin finds sad. Not that a company is making business choices he dislikes, but that the community's connective tissue is embedded in a platform it doesn't control. The question worth sitting with is whether the GitHub era was a detour or a lesson. The old model, where maintainers ran their own forges and grouped into collectives to share the burden, that model produced slower growth but deeper sovereignty. The tools to return to something like it exists now. Gitea is self-hostable and simple. Radical is peer-to-peer. Codeberg is a non-profit. Zig moved there. The path is open. Armin wants a public, boring, well-funded archive for open-source software. Something with the staying power of an institution, not a product. That's not nostalgia. That's an engineering requirement. The commons needs infrastructure that outlasts any single company's product roadmap. Moving on. Tindy went dark. No warning, no countdown timer, no maintenance page with a progress bar. Just gone. For weeks, the marketplace where independent hardware creators sold their boards, their kits, their weird and wonderful creations to the world simply ceased to exist. And then an email arrived from someone named Gong Yu Su, representing eTree LLC, a Washington state company, saying they'd bought the whole thing and were working to bring it back. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Maybe this is fine. Maybe a new owner with fresh capital and engineering resources is exactly what a neglected marketplace needs. The letter says the right things. Stabilize, resolve payment issues, invest long term, and eTree, the parent entity behind the LLC, runs eTree.cn, which is a legitimate electronics education and community platform in China. They understand hardware culture. They understand makers. On paper, this could be a rescue. But here's a constraint that makes this story worth pulling apart. Tindy isn't just a storefront. It's a trust engine. Every seller on that platform built a reputation through reviews, through completed orders, through years of showing up. Every buyer learned which obscure sensor breakout board actually works, because someone else bought it first and said so. That social infrastructure is the product. The Rails app, running on whatever aging stack they inherited, is just the container. And that container went dark. With no explanation, while money was in transit. Orders placed, payments pending. Sellers waiting on disbursements. The new team's own letter admits the migration was more complex than expected, which is honest. But honesty after weeks of silence reads differently than honesty on day one. The comments dig up what the announcement doesn't say. Nobody uses the word bankrupt, but the pattern fits. Sudden sale, no transition period. The previous owner's social media manager posted a statement to a self-destructing paste link. That's not a planned handoff, that's triage. What makes this ache is that Tindy represented something genuinely good. A place where someone who designed a clever little ESP32 module in their garage could reach buyers worldwide without navigating Amazon's labyrinth or building their own e-commerce stack. The makers who depend on it didn't choose to have their livelihoods migrate to a new database over a long weekend. The lesson repeating itself across every platform story this year is architectural. When your marketplace, your community, your revenue all live on infrastructure you don't control, you are one acquisition away from darkness. The tools for seller sovereign commerce exist. WooCommerce is open. Medusa is open, but nobody uses them because Tindy's aggregation effect was the whole point. Trust must be earned through action. The letter says, true, but the first action was disappearing. Everything after that is catch-up. 9 stories in and we haven't talked about Rust yet. Pause, let's fix that immediately. I spent 6 months last year building a data pipeline that was supposed to be simple. 14 dbt models, a handful of seeds, some snapshots. By month 3, someone changed a column type in our source system, and we didn't find out until a dashboard started showing nulls where revenue numbers should be. Classic. We added tests, added contracts, added more tests. On top of the tests, the pipeline got slower. The feedback loop got longer. The whole thing felt like trying to debug a building by reading the blueprints while the building is on fire. Rocky is a Rust-based control plane for warehouse pipelines. And the metaphor I keep reaching for is version control for your data layer. The way Git is version control for code. Det conceptually. Literally. Det conceptually. Named branches. Where you spin up an isolated schema, run your transformations against it, inspect the results, and either promote or drop. Column-level lineage that traces a single field from a downstream fact table back through every aggregation to the original seed. Schema drift detection that catches type changes at compile time before a single row gets written. Surfacing diagnostic codes the way a compiler surfaces type errors. The architecture is a 20-crate cargo workspace. The playground runs entirely on local DuckDB. No credentials, no cloud account. You can have a working pipeline in 60 seconds. It integrates with Dagster, ships a VS Code extension with LSP support, and has an AI model generation loop that describes what you want in English, generates the DSL, compiles it, and retries on parse failure automatically. The Hacker News comments are revealing. Someone immediately flagged the README as having LL smell, which is fair criticism and also exactly the kind of thing that distracts from substance. Another commenter noted that Databricks already owns the DAG through its jobs and pipelines product, which is true and also kind of the point. Databricks owns the DAG. That's the problem Rocky is solving. You keep your warehouse, you bring Rocky for the control plane, the DAG lives in your repo, versioned, branchable, compilable. The interesting contrast is with DBT, which got acquired, and SQL Mesh, same story. One commenter said they'd been waiting for someone to build exactly this since those acquisitions. Apache licensed Rust Core local first development loop. This is what data engineering tooling looks like when the control plane is yours to keep. So we've been talking about reshaping data pipelines. But what happens when you try to reshape something far older and far more stubborn? Let me make the strongest case for why law should stay exactly as it is. Messy, layered, impenetrable to outsiders. The argument goes like this. Legal complexity is a feature. Ambiguity creates space for judicial interpretation. Human judgment fills the gaps between rigid rules and messy reality. If you formalize law into something a machine can parse, you lose the flexibility that makes it work. It's a good argument, and it completely falls apart the moment you ask who benefits from that complexity. This article on lawmenendio.robert.matacami. This article on Lawman NW and Enazabin, Daping Sabio, why you with discreet great ravenant with the olurky. Lawman NDO ravenant a dubber that, by a wa. Lay on me, the lorca scub. Lay a amen NDO wabber that, so Joe Jill, sign P by you. Parliament doesn't restate the entire legal corpus each session. For the same reason you don't rewrite your application from scratch every sprint. You patch. You amend. You hope the cross-references still resolve. And here's where the reductio kicks in. Follow the complexity, Elf-Piescher argument to its logical end. If ambiguity serves justice, then the system should get more just as it gets more opaque. Run that forward a few centuries. You get exactly what we have. The amendment offers, so layered that understanding your own rights requires hiring a specialist who bills by the hour. The flexibility argument didn't produce flexibility. It produced a priesthood. The article points out that statutes look like trees on paper, but operate as graphs. Cross-references, conditional overrides, cross-jurisdiction dependencies. The tree is just a serialization format for printing on paper. The actual relationships are invisible unless you compute them. One commenter mentioned Audrey Tang's work in Taiwan, making legislation machine readable and publicly auditable. That's the existence proof. The tools exist. The standards exist. A comment also a lie. Legal rule ML. What's missing is the political will to make law as inspectable as the open source code that already solved this problem decades ago. Law that citizens can't parse without professional intermediaries isn't serving citizens. It's serving intermediaries. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for April 29th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that answers to you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.